We continue now with the tale of how the Baruch, the Alter Rebbe's father, became a chassid of the Baal Shem Tov. We have recently been relating how Rachel, the mother of Dvar Leah, who is also the mother of Rabbi Baruch, was herself a very learned woman, and how her husband, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who the Alter Rebbe was named after, was initially not in favor of his wife's learning because of the background where he had come from. In any event, Dvar Leah had seriously wanted to learn, and in the case of her own daughter, that means Rachel's daughter, Dvar Leah, Rachel did not attempt to teach Dvar Leah until Dvar Leah herself had shown her how much it meant to her happiness in life. And when Rachel began to give her Torah lessons, she did so regularly and systematically. And so, in the course of time, Dvar Leah too became quite a scholar. Although Rachel had undertaken to teach her daughter secretly, knowing that her husband would not approve, it was against her nature to keep anything back from her husband for long. They had always confided in each other and trusted each other implicitly. Rachel therefore took the first opportunity, when Dvar Leah was already far advanced in her studies, of telling her husband of their lessons together. And to their great surprise, he said not a word against it. Baruch and his sister Dvar Leah differed not only in age, but also in character. Brother and sister were two entirely different people, as if they had come from different parents. Dvar Leah was like her mother, full of sentiment and fond of her fellow beings, always interested in her neighbors, ever ready to help everyone. Baruch, on the other hand, was exactly like his father, cold and reserved, and like him too, preferring his own company to that of others. Dvar Leah made remarkable progress in her studies, but she had so much that she wished to ask them about, in her eagerness to learn as much as possible, that she felt she was troubling her mother too much. She dared not ask her father. She did not feel comfortable about talking to him. Such was their reserved relationship. But she would gladly have asked her younger brother, who despite his tender years had an excellent brain and was indeed very clever and learned. But because of Baruch's cold nature, there was no bond between them. Baruch regarded Dvar Leah not as a sister of his own flesh and blood, but as if she were a stranger, and a girl at that, so he had no time for her. Dvar Leah was very grieved at her brother's attitude. It hurt her very much. Her mother saw it and realized that her son's conduct was wrong, but it was beyond her comprehension. She was really angry with her young son and thought it might do him good to hear something of the family history that she had already told to Dvar Leah. It might make him a little more understanding. But Baruch seemed so unapproachable that she kept putting it off, thinking she would wait until he was a little older and more sympathetic and appreciative of all that the family tradition held for them. She hoped that it would have the same effect upon him that it had upon his sister, Dvar Leah. Unfortunately, Rachel put off the telling so long that it was then too late. She suddenly became sick and realized she was dying. She called in her children, Dvar Leah and Baruch, and apparently wanted to tell them something, but her strength was too far spent. She just managed to say vidui, and extending her shrunken hands over their heads, she blessed them. Then with her last breath, she said Shema Yisrael and closed her eyes forever. Dvoraleya screamed for her father to come in, but Rochel was already dead. Shneur Zalman broke down and wept at the passing of his dear wife, who had been such a wonderful wife and mother. Dvoraleya was quite hysterical in her grief, but Baruch was just bewildered and remained dry-eyed. Only when he saw his mother being lifted from her bed and laid on the floor did he realize the extent of his loss, and then he too broke down so completely that he fell into a faint. The death of his wife had a devastating effect upon Shneur Zalman, so much so that he had to give up his teaching and try to earn his living by helping a certain scholar from Vitebsk to put his writings in order. But even this proved beyond his dwindling strength. Dvoraleya was 16 years old at this time, and found some consolation from her deep wound in giving her devotion completely to looking after her father, brother, and household. Baruch was still as distant in his attitude as ever, but this did not deter Dvoraleya from giving of her best to provide for the comfort of her father and brother. She was a very good needlewoman, and when she saw that it was becoming increasingly difficult for her father to do anything, she decided she would now become the breadwinner of the family. Dvoraleya worked very hard at her sewing and managed to earn sufficient to keep the wolf from the door, as the saying goes. She also naturally did all the housework and cooking, as well as looking after her ailing father. He became weaker from day to day, and before very long, he too was at his last. Shneur Zalman called Dvoraleya and Baruch to him and reminded them that they must realize from what a great and noble ancestry they came, and they must live up to the family traditions, saying which he breathed his last. Dvoraleya would have tried to continue with her sewing and looking after her brother as before. She would also have liked him to teach her Torah, but Baruch had already made his preparations for leaving Vitebsk. Dvoraleya was later invited by her aunt Freida and uncle Kaddish to come and live with them, for how could such a young girl be alone in the world? Her grandfather Moshe was in Minsk, wanted her to come to him, and Baruch too. But Baruch, as you will recall, had by this time disappeared without leaving any trace as to his whereabouts. Dvoraleya might have gone to live with her grandfather, but she did not want to leave Vitebsk because of her parents' graves were there, for these graves were now a precious part of her life. She would often go there and pour out her heart by the graves of her dear departed parents. She never cried. She just told her parents of her problems, her troubles, and felt greatly relieved in the telling. This was chiefly why she agreed to go and live with her aunt and uncle, but she stipulated that they must allow her to continue to earn her own living by sewing, which, interestingly enough, was very much like Baruch, her brother, who also insisted that he earn always his own keep. Thus Dvoraleya continued until one day her uncle and aunt told her that they had a very nice young man for her, the young genius Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok. Dvoraleya immediately hurried off to her parents' graves to tell them about this important matter. She begged them to give the match their blessing only if it would prove successful, but otherwise she asked them to make it to naught that this marriage not come to pass. After this, Dvoraleya agreed to meet the young man. She told him all that her mother had told her of her lineage, and added that she herself was more inclined to follow her mother's side of ancestry with its conduct ruled by the teachings of Kabbalah and Hasidus. The young man listened to Dvoraleya very courteously and with interest. Then he too told of his lineage, of which he was very proud. He told Dvoraleya, to her great great joy that he had long ago made the acquaintance of a certain follower of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, and he had acquainted him thoroughly with the ways of this leader of the age. Most important of all, the young man expressed himself as being entirely in sympathy with this way of life. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok also told her that this follower of the Baal Shem Tov had brought him to see this great personality, who had told him that he would find his real zivuk, his real mate, in Vitebsk, that she came from a very fine family and was an orphan, which perfectly described Veraleya. Veraleya was overjoyed at everything the young man told her. She saw the Yad Hashem, the hand of God, in all that had led up to the present meeting, and felt no doubt whatever that this match was the right one for her. Veraleya took her young man to her parents' graves, and there they plighted their troth secretly. They became engaged secretly and made the following condition. First, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok was to give her a lesson twice or three times a week. Second, he was not to raise any objections to her continuing with her sewing and helping to support their future home together. Third, they were to share equally in all they did relating to Torah and mitzvahs. Fourth, they were to keep the fact that she was studying Torah a secret. Fifth, they were to live as followers of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, that is, as chassidim. Sixth, that this fact too should remain a secret until it could be revealed. Seventh, that if they would be blessed with children, they would rear them in the spirit of chassidus. Eighth, that if they would have a daughter, she too would be taught Torah. And finally, ninth, that from all their earnings they would put aside a tenth part, miser, for charity, for tzedakah. After their marriage, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok was appointed as Rosh Yeshiva and the Vitebsk Yeshiva, and Veraleya was very happy. There was just one thing which saddened her life, and that was that she did not know what had become of her younger brother, Baruch. Although she said little about this secret sorrow to her husband, she often poured out her worries at her parents' graves and prayed that they wash over their lost son so that no harm come to him. Veraleya's husband, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, was a native of Sharya, a small town in Mogilev. There were only about 45 Jewish families in this little townlet. As in many other small towns, they had a number of scholars, young men who had married there and whose fathers-in-law provided for them so that they were free to devote their time to Torah learning. In this way, the spirit of Torah permeated the place. But the majority of the residents were just ordinary, uneducated Jews, whose height of literacy was that they could daven and recite a few brokim, a few chapters of Tehillim. A few, maybe, could also understand a chapter of the Chumash, but as already stated, the majority had had very little education at all and could barely read. These men could not even daven with a minyan, but had to satisfy themselves with reciting the Shema, the Shemoneh Esrei, and a few more important prayers which they had managed to learn by heart. The Rav of Sharye was Reb Shmuel Akiva. Reb Shmuel Akiva's Torah knowledge was not particularly great, but to compensate for this, he was exceedingly pious. For a period of 50 years, he had been fasting daily from Shabbos to Shabbos and taking upon himself all sorts of penances. During the winter, he would roll naked in the snow, and during the summer, he would roll himself naked on nests of ants which bit him until they drew blood. His father-in-law, Rab Chaim Moshe of Pinchev, a disciple of Rab Yontev Heller, the author of Tosfos Yontev, was Rav in Sharya before him. Rab Shmuel Akiva married the latter's eldest daughter. Because of his extreme frumkeit, his God-fearingness, his father-in-law turned him into a preacher, and he began to preach sermons regularly. His sermons were full of fire and threw the fear of God into all his listeners, scholars and non-scholars alike. He always painted lurid pictures of the punishments that awaited those who did not adhere strictly to the precepts of the Torah. After his father-in-law's death, he stepped into his position as Rav of the town, continuing with his fasts, his penances, and with his fiery sermons, which positively curdled the blood of his audience. Like all other scholars of his time, he remained aloof from the uneducated Jews, and so these unfortunate people had no one to guide them, and certainly no one who thought it worthwhile to spend any time in teaching them. One of these uneducated Jews in Sharjah was a certain Yaakov Karpel, who made his living by traveling in the surrounding villages, returning home for Shabbos. Before going home to his wife, he would always first call on the Rav of Sharjah and give him donations to the various local charities. For Sharjah, like other Jewish communities, had its Society for Sick Visiting, Society for Helping Poor Brides, Society for Clothing Poor People, the Talmud Torah, and so on and so forth. Having given what he could to the Rav in support of these charities, Yaakov Karpel would then make his way to the Beis HaMedrash, where he would throw some coins in the Tzedakah Pushke, in the charity box, which stood there, so that he would also be complying with the mitzvah of Matan Beseser, giving charity anonymously. For naturally, no one knew who or how much anyone put into this charity box. Only after all this would Yaakov Karpel go home and prepare himself for the Holy Shabbos. As we already know, Yaakov Karpel was one of those uneducated people who could not properly read. He could only daven insofar as he could repeat the prayers he knew by heart, and these were limited to the Shema and the Shemoneh Esrei, which he had learned with great difficulty during the course of the years. Although he repeated these prayers with many mistakes, he nevertheless put all his heart and soul into them, whether he happened to be wandering about in the villages or in the Beis HaMedrash on Shabbos or Yontif. He would daven with the fullest degree of kavona that he could, with the greatest degree of intent and feeling that he was capable of. His wife, Tzipa Broche, was as uneducated as her husband, and equally as devout. She was the daughter of the attendant at the local baths. She was orphaned at an early age, and the community cared for her and arranged her marriage with Yaakov Karpel. They were very happy in their marriage, but unfortunately had trouble regarding children. For quite a long time they were childless, and unfortunately later, when Tzipa Broche bore her husband children, they died. Once, during Yaakov Karpel's travels through the villages, he met a man who was traveling like himself. So they decided to travel together. Yaakov noticed that the man kept moving his lips and murmuring something, as if talking to himself. Finally, after wondering at this strange conduct for a long time, Yaakov Karpel plucked up his courage and asked his companion what he was doing, to which his companion replied that he was chazering Mishnayos, he was repeating Mishnayos, which he had learned by heart. "I always do this when I am on the road without any books with me," he said. "As soon as I reach any place where there is a Beis HaMedrash, I can then study Gemara and other holy books. But I know the Tanakh and the Mishnayos by heart, and so that's what I would always say on my journeys." Now that Yaakov Karpel knew what his companion was murmuring so secretively, his companion began to repeat his studies in a loud voice and with a most beautiful tune, which captured Yaakov's heart. Yaakov Karpel began to cry. "Why are you crying?" his companion asked him sympathetically. How can I not cry when I realize what a terrible ignoramus I am? I can barely read properly, let alone study. How I envy you your knowledge and learning, cried out Yankov Karpel emotionally. The stranger looked at him kindly and comforted him, promising he would teach him from the very beginning of the Olive Base as soon as he would reach Sharye and Yankov Karpel would be at home. Yankov Karpel was moved beyond expression, and his eyes said all that his lips could not say, for his heart was very full. I will do this for you on one condition only, said the stranger, whose name was Herr Schleib. No one must know anything about it. What happened to Yankov Karpel and how this relates to Zoya Leah and Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, her husband, that is the sister and the brother-in-law of Rabbi Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, Emir Tzashem, and the coming installation.